I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and I couldn't get my hands on your Bruce book fast enough. I love the work, and now that you've got Paul Simon here, you've got some great stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Why did you choose Paul as your next subject?
Well, I felt like there was just an interesting lack of information about him out there, and as someone who had followed him since I was about five, you know, one of my earliest music memories is sitting in the backyard in the summer of 1968 as a little kid and playing with my trucks all summer long, and hearing one song coming out of everyone's AM radio about 18 minutes. Every 18 minutes for the entire summer, and that was Mrs. Robinson by Simon and Garfunkel. And so his voice has been in my head ever since then. And, you know, and I have memories tied to his work going all the way back to there and all the way up through, you know, seeing him play just a couple months ago. And so it just seemed to me, you know, I always go out and kind of look for the book that I want to read about something or someone, and if it doesn't exist, and I have that kind of interest, then, you know, the only option is to try to write it myself. And so, of course, that's what I set out to do.
I do have to ask, you were listening to Mrs. Robinson when you were five?
There was no choice because I was out back. I was out back, and it was on the AM. Everyone tuned to the same AM radio in Seattle in my neighborhood, and they were all out in the sun with their radios blasting. And if I was just going to exist, I was going to be listening to that song, you know, on heavy rotation.
True Top 40 radio then, absolutely. We're talking with Peter Ames Carlin. The book is Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. I'm trying to wrap my head around the fact that Paul Simon's 75. He'll always be, the book cover, that's who he'll always be to me, that face.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that's who he'll always be to Paul, too. You know, I mean, you know how that goes.
Yeah.
When I get up in the morning and look in the mirror, I'm like, oh, that's a terrible mistake. I know, but, you know, the amazing thing is that he's, through all those years, has kept growing and changing and evolving as an artist. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, he's always been so successful, that there's never really been a point where you would listen to him and think like, oh, he's just sort of redoing what he did a few years ago. You know, even the tours, when he does his reunion tours with Art Garfunkel, you know, I went to see them in 2002, and I was just impressed with how much they got into the arrangements and of their well-known songs and changed them around, and you know, and the songs just sounded fresh and new all over again, which is, you know, a testament not only to Paul's musicianship and Artie's as well, but to the fact that you know, the depth of those songs. You know, a really great song can be torn apart and put back together any number of ways, and it's still fantastic.
Oh, it sure can. And since you brought up Art Garfunkel already, I mean, they go way back. They go back to school. Wait, what? Grade school?
Grade school, I think second grade. They first sort of saw each other, and Artie's performance at school in the cafeteria one day inspired Paul to get deeper into music, and he's been sort of chasing that dream and caught it many, many times ever since. And they started singing together when they were 11, and of course by the time they were 15, 16 years old, they had written a handful of songs together and would take them to Midtown Manhattan and knock on doors at the Brill Building and the other buildings to try to sell them, you know. And, you know, they were sort of getting a certain amount of attention and sort of nearly making it until they wrote Hey Schoolgirl when they were just, I think, the summer between their junior and senior year in high school. And by November of the next fall, it was, you know, at the top of the charts in the Northeast.
And that's when they were Tom and Jerry, right?
Yeah, they were called Tom and Jerry back then.
Wow.
And sold enough copies to get into the top 40, I think, or just missed the top 40 in the Billboard's national charts. And then, you know, they sort of went their separate ways for a while, and then when they reunited in the early 60s, it only took a couple years for them to record the original version of Sound of Silence, and then when that flopped, you know, sort of look in other directions and then suddenly be told that that there was an electric version of it rolling around that Columbia Records had put together, and now they had a number one hit. And from there, from there came history.
Oh, absolutely. How would you describe the relationship between Paul and Artie?
Operatic, I think, would be a good word.
That's good.
They have this love-hate relationship that has sort of existed for, they say, since the day after they became friends. But, what was one of the fascinating things that I learned along the way of writing the book was that the seed of the kind of disunion between them goes back to just a few weeks before they recorded that first song, Hey Schoolgirl. Paul and his dad, who was also in the music industry, were negotiating the contract with the record company to put out Hey Schoolgirl. They secretly, without telling Artie or his parents, hammered out a side deal for Paul to start a solo career with the label at the same time. And Paul, Lou wrote a song. Lou Simon, his father, wrote a song, and Paul performed it and wrote a song for the B-side of this record that that ended up being released under the name True Taylor, one of Paul's many pseudonyms that he would use in the first 10 years of his career. And it was a huge flop, and Artie was so outraged by, the obvious double cross that even though he forgave Paul, in the short run, that seed of anger never went away.
Do you think that is reflected in the music, and does it make it better?
Well, it's interesting. When Columbia Records got around to releasing the first official Simon and Garfunkel bio in early 66, late 65, one of the points of discussion in the biography was how they had feuded before.
Mm-hmm.
And now they had sort of gotten back together and everything was cool and would always be cool. And so that seed of tension, that kind of, that little bit of dissonance between them has always kind of been at least a low rumble underneath, their beautiful harmonies and stuff. And in a way, you could say, in the same way that a drop of black will make white paint more white, some weird chemical reaction, I think that seed of darkness in their relationship makes their harmonies sound that much more beautiful.
Mm. If you grew up in the 60s, you were hearing all of their amazing songs. Going into the 70s, you heard a lot of Paul going solo, and then getting back together in the 80s for that insanely beautiful concert in Central Park. How did that come about?
Well, both of them had had kind of career, missteps in the year or two leading up to that. They had recorded one reunion song in 1975 and took a little stab at performing together again in the mid-70s, like around that, but it didn't quite take. But 5-6 years later, when they both had had a little problems, and Paul had been offered this slot of headlining this benefit concert for the Central Park concern that was funding all, the care of Central Park, was just launching then. And he took it, but then immediately became terrified that, no one or hardly anyone was going to show up to just a Paul Simon show. So in order to make it more of an capital E event, he thought, well, maybe Artie should be a part of this. And they talked about it for a little while, and by the time they finished talking, it had become an entire, 2.5 hour long Simon and Garfunkel show. And of course that, especially in the wake of John Lennon's assassination earlier, the reunion of these kind of sweet, 60s heroes, I think, sort of worked in a powerful way in the consciousness of the baby boom people who were just then reaching toward their 40s and having been traumatized by the death of John Lennon. I think this idea that, this innocence and this harmony and this sweetness still exists. You can, you can go home again type of feeling. And obviously it resonated in a huge way.
It really did. I think it was one of the stations here was during a fundraising. PBS replayed the concert from Central Park. And just sitting there and watching and listening, I was getting chill after chill after chill. I mean, their music is timeless.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's because it's so full of feeling and so full of love and anguish. And these are evergreen feelings, you know,
oh, yeah.
in the human soul. And I think, you know, generation after generation of people kind of latch on to it and get it immediately. You know, so it's so fascinating to realize that when Hey Schoolgirl came out, it was it was released as a 45 record and also a 78. It was, I think, one of the last pop songs to come out as a 78, which was the modern technology, like in the 20s, you know. So, and then Paul's most recent record had the single Wristband, mm-hmm. which was a contender, was played a lot on college radio this year, you know. So somebody could span 78s and MP3s and the cloud, you know. I mean, it's a phenomenal chunk of history.
So is there hope for millennials still, if they understand his music?
Oh, there's always hope for millennials. And then, you know, the millennials will grow and thrive and then survive long enough to look at their own children and say, what a lame generation.
I love that. When you, I have to ask you this. In the book, you were describing Paul as having a sadness about him, even as a baby. And I look at the cover art. I look at his picture. And it's not sadness, but there's such a depth of looking at him. Is he a very complicated kind of guy? Would you describe him that way?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Extremely complicated. I mean, all people are. You know, we all contain multitudes of good and bad and shades of gray. But, you know, as somebody who, with a consciousness and a creativity and a spirit as wild and deep as his, you know, all that comes in even larger forms. You know, it's kind of cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way that he can be a remarkably sweet and loving and obviously, you know, a brilliant artist, he can also be at times, you know, sort of strikingly chilly and even mean-spirited at times. And, you know, and that's something that I think is just sort of a part of his soul, you know. In a way, you know, you have these beautiful waves that come through someone, but then you have an undertow. And, you know, in every person I've written about or studied in depth, I mean, you can always identify it. The same thing that inspires you to create something beautiful is the thing that tears away at it, you know. And some people have that more in balance than other people.
Quite true.
Or are able to hide it better than other people.
Good
but,
point.
Paul has always had his feelings very, very close to his chest.
Well, with that sort of privacy, when you started researching the book, when you decided to write about Paul, what kind of roadblocks did you run into from people you wanted to talk to?
Well, the first major roadblock was Paul Simon himself, who, you know, unlike Bruce Springsteen and Brian Wilson, who I had written about, you know, years earlier, just was absolutely opposed to my writing anything about him, and did, you know, and really sort of started to do everything he could to stop other people from talking to me, which was kind of a pain. I mean, it was disappointing, but
yeah.
If you're, you know, in investigative journalism, you know, as I've been trained to be, that just, you know, it just creates other opportunities and other doors to go through. And so, you know, I spent the three and a half years I spent working on the book, you know, and talked to eventually more than 100 people, you know, everyone from school chums, neighborhood friends, all the way up to people who were involved in his most recent record and the most recent tour. So, you know, there was just legions of people from all over the world who were ready and eager to talk about Paul and their relationship with him. And so, you know, it was fascinating the amount of information there was to, you know, just to be picked off the tree.
Well, the book is wonderful. It's hard to put down, and I'm not lending it to anyone right now because I don't think they're going to give it back to me. But when you go in to choose someone to really talk about their life, like Paul Simon, was there anybody out there that you wanted to talk to that you could not get to?
Oh, of course. I mean, Paul himself, you know, for one thing. You know, Artie Garfunkel was the same way, essentially. Working on his own thing or just not wanting to deal with, I think, such an intensive project. You know, and there were people who were close to Paul who would have been fantastic to talk to, but he, you know, he asked them not to talk to me, so that was the end of that. And you have to admire that. I mean, people are loyal to their friend, you know, and people should all be loyal to their friend, so I don't resent that at all. I think in some ways, it's, in many ways, it's a testament to good character. So, you know, you can't argue with that. But, you know, again, there's so many other avenues to go down and so many different kinds of information and archives and recordings and, you know, and all kinds of stuff out there that, that can shed, you know, all sorts of unexpected light on a person.
What was the one thing that surprised you the most about him, his life?
Well, the most surprising thing, I think, I mean, along with how far back his you know, that first sort of original sin in the Simon and Garfunkel relationship was, is I think just the incredible distance between the Paul who does wonderful things that people recall sort of while blinking back tears of gratitude. You know, the amount, how generous he could be to people and how he can take people, you know, how he created careers for the Roaches, the great singing group.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Bodie, the trumpeter, and a fellow named Jackson C. Frank from the 60s, who was an extremely talented songwriter Paul admired, but who never, you know, found an audience and had his own, you know, emotional problems to deal with. And these are people Paul invested a significant amount of money into and time and effort and, but then there are other people who he has just blatantly sort of kind of ripped off, you know. I mean, in ways that are not illegal, you know, things that he knew how to do because he had spent so much time learning the ropes as a, you know, as a young person in the music industry. And it's like, how can these two faces, you know, exist within the same person? But, you know, that's part of the, you know, the complexity of his character and to some extent, you know, everyone's character.
Well, you know, I'm going to leave it at that because we want to make sure people buy the book and get the real inside story from you. I've got to tell you, it was wonderful to talk to you, Peter. I loved your work with Bruce, but I have to ask you, what's next?
Oh, well, I'm kicking around some ideas. I think it's going to be a music book, but I don't think it's going to be a biography per se. Maybe more of a book about working musicians and what it's like, especially, because, you know, we all go to shows and you see bands in the clubs and a lot of these performers are my age, you know, in their 50s and 40s and still doing it with as much dedication as ever, you know, and living the same kind of life, children and families and homes and soccer practice. And to me, that's an interesting line to walk.
Oh, I agree. It's not an easy life, and not everyone's going to be a star. It's tough.
Yeah, but you can still have a whole lot of fun and be enormously fulfilled by it, and that's, I think that's fascinating.